This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining us today in the Jodcast studio is Dr. Michael Keith. Hi, Dr. Keith.
Hello.
Dr. Keith is a recent arrival to JBCA, having come all the way from the far reaches of Australia, and he's now working in the Pulsar group here at JBCA, which most of our listeners know is one of the big areas of research here at Jodrell Bank. So tell us a bit about yourself and what you were doing before you came to Jodrell Bank.
Okay, so before I started here at Jodrell Bank, I was working for the CSIRO in Australia, which is one of the Australia's biggest research organisations, and I was working there with the Parkes Radio Telescope, which is another telescope similar to the one we have here at Jodrell, but in the middle of nowhere in Australia instead of in the middle of Cheshire in England.
Pretty isolated either way, I think.
Yeah, sheep all around.
And so what aspect of pulsars are you focusing on in your research?
So, I focus on two things, one of which is looking for new pulsars, which is a cool thing if you like pulsars. But I'm also looking at using them for detecting gravitational waves, which is one of the really hot topics for astronomers these days.
So a common thread between Parkes and Jodrell Bank, actually, is that they're both single-dish telescopes, and a lot of new telescopes up and coming tend to be arrays nowadays, but why do pulsar astronomers still prefer single-dish telescopes?
Well, in principle, it's because the pulsars are very weak objects, and we need a lot of collecting area. So a big dish like the Lovell gives us all the gain we need to detect these weak objects. And for the most part, we don't need the imaging capabilities that the multi-dish telescopes give you.
I see. So are you continuing the work that you did at Parkes here at Jodrell Bank? And in fact, are you using Jodrell Bank itself? Or have you started work on something completely different?
So, well, even when I was working at Parkes, I still was working with the people here at Jodrell. And we, for instance, when we did our big survey at Parkes to look for pulsars, we don't get as much time with Parkes as we can get here with the Lovell. So the pulsars that we discover, we typically time here at Jodrell because we get a lot more observing time here and we can time them more regularly. And with pulsars, you really need to observe them every week or something in order to track their rotation over the year.
Okay. So you discover pulsars, then you have to time them, and how does that relate at all to these gravitational waves? First of all, could you explain what gravitational waves are and why they're interesting? And 'cause I'm not sure most of our listeners will be that familiar with them. And then why it's good to use pulsars to actually detect these things.
So most of the astronomy we do is with electromagnetic radiation. So either radio waves like we do here at Jodrell, or in optical like you might do with a telescope at home. But there's another radiation predicted by Einstein's general relativity, which is gravitational wave radiation. And these are effectively small ripples in space-time that travel out from massive objects, so that's heavy objects, and could in principle be detected here on Earth. Unfortunately, those signals are very weak, so we need either a very sensitive instrument or we need a very long distance over which to measure them. And because pulsars are a long way away, we can measure the space-time ripples passing over the pulsars, and so we can try and detect this. But as I said, it is an incredibly weak signal, and so we've not yet been able to make this detection, but we're getting closer and closer every day.
But in that case, would you need the pulsar to be close to another massive object, or does the pulsar itself give off the waves? How does it work exactly?
So the waves that we detect mostly come from, in fact, distant galaxies, and it's the supermassive black holes that sit at the centers of these distant galaxies, and they emit the gravitational wave radiation. And as it passes over our galaxy, we see the effect in all the pulsars that we observe that are throughout our galaxy.
So does it cause a little sort of bump in the signal or some sort of delay?
So what we see is we see all the pulsars changing together. So if all the pulsar signals change together, we know that either there's something wrong with our system, which we can check, or we know that there's something going on that is affecting the whole galaxy, basically. And this is the gravitational waves radiation.
Nice. So what happens when you finally detect a gravitational wave? I mean, this is a test of Einstein's general relativity, isn't it?
Well, we know that these gravitational waves exist from observations of binary pulsars, and we've seen the orbit of the binary shrinking due to the gravitational wave energy coming out. So we do know they exist, we've just never directly observed them. If we can observe the gravitational waves, we can find out about black holes in the centers of distant galaxies that we can't see otherwise. And this tells us things about how galaxies are formed and how black holes are put together. And, you know, we really don't know a lot about where black holes come from.
That's true. And I guess it'll just open a whole new domain of astronomy, basically, gravitational wave astronomy, is extending it even past the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah. So it's very similar to how in the early 20th century, radio astronomy came about, and we started building radio telescopes, and we learned a whole lot of new stuff about the universe. If we can open the gravitational wave window and combine that with our optical and radio and infrared, you know, we'll have another whole new explosion in understanding of the way the universe works.
That's brilliant. So the search for gravitational waves goes on, and you mentioned also detecting new pulsars. Astronomers have found, something in like the thousands, tens of thousand pulsars already?
So we know 2,000 pulsars at the moment. It seems like a lot, but pulsars are very weird objects, and they have many different behaviors. And so only by getting lots of pulsars can we really work out, you know, what makes pulsars tick, because they each need to be doing slightly different things. So it's a real challenge. But the other thing is that not all of these pulsars are useful for the very important experiments like the gravitational wave experiment. So only say 10 or 20 pulsars that we know of so far are really useful for this. And we need to find more of them to increase our sensitivity to gravitational waves, and to go from the sort of just maybe detecting it to actually doing really exciting science. As I was saying, like understanding how black holes are formed, we want to find more of these pulsars to really drive this.
So just finding a pulsar in itself isn't that exciting of an event anymore, I guess, for you? Or
It's still pretty exciting. I mean, it's seeing something that nobody's ever seen before and finding new things, and every pulsar could be really exciting. Like I was saying, you know, lots of these pulsars have very unique properties, and so when you see something, you don't know if that's going to be the one that's doing something really exotic and really exciting and makes you excited, you know, gives you something to do for the next year or something.
Yeah, sure, because I guess that's what you were saying, that once you find a pulsar, you still have to time it and look at it for a while before you can get all its characteristics out. So bringing me to my next question, what specifically are you looking for in terms of what you call an interesting pulsar, one that can help you detect gravitational waves? What sets them apart?
So the pulsars that are really good for the gravitational wave experiment are the fastest millisecond pulsars. So these are pulsars that spin round maybe 500 or 700 times in a second. So this is you know, an object that's as heavy as the sun, it's the size of a city like Manchester, and it's spinning around faster than your kitchen blender. So this is a seriously extreme environment, but it's this very rapid rotation that makes them useful for this experiment, because we can get the highest precision of the arrival times of the signal.
So you're saying you only have 10 or 20 of those. So what are the experiments that you have ongoing to detect millisecond pulsars?
So, I mean, the experiment that I'm most closely involved with is with the Parkes Radio Telescope, and this is the High Time Resolution Universe Survey, where we're surveying the entire southern sky for looking essentially for these millisecond pulsars.
And so in the Parkes survey, I believe that you and your collaborators found an object that got quite a bit of media interest, actually. So could you tell us a bit about that?
So I suspect this is the diamond planet you're referring to.
Yep.
So this was a pulsar we discovered a few years ago now. And when we were observing it here at Jodrell, we noticed that its arrival time seemed to vary with a 12-hour periodicity. And when we looked into this, we discovered that it seemed to have a planetary mass companion, so something that had the same mass about as Jupiter, going around it. But if you do the physics, you can see that this planet must be much closer to the pulsar than Jupiter would fit. And so it must be a very dense object. And because we understand how the pulsar has formed, we know that this planet must have once been a star. It's a really extraordinary thing, because the star would have had about the same mass as the Sun, and it's gone down to something that's a thousandth of that mass. So it's lost something like 99.99% of its mass, and left just this very little core, which we understand is made of carbon, and is in this crystal structure, and so we think of it as a diamond. So it's this very exotic system where you had a star once, it's been blasted by this pulsar, turned into a planet-like thing, which is made of pure carbon and looks like a big diamond.
That is seriously cool. Many surprises yet to come, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
So one last aspect of your research, and which I think is equally as cool as diamond planets, is the so-called fast radio bursts. So I'm not going to talk about this. I'm going to let you describe what it is we're on about exactly.
Yeah, okay. So these are bursts that we saw at parks, where we got a single event coming from the sky that lasted for about a millisecond, but it was very bright and coming from a bit of sky that we didn't think there was anything in. And it seemed to be coming from a very long way away, so well outside of our galaxy. And this puzzled astronomers for a long time, because we only saw the one event. But recently, myself and collaborators here and in Australia discovered four more of these events. And so we now know that these really are, firstly, coming from a really long way away, so at cosmological distances. The furthest one is back to half the age of the universe. And they're very, very bright, and it turns out that there's a really lot of them happening all the time, but it's just because our telescopes can only see a small part of the sky at once, and they only last for a millisecond, that we don't see very many. In fact, we think there's something like 10,000 over the whole sky coming per day.
Oh, wow. So it's just difficult to spot them because they happen so quickly in like little flashes, I guess, of radio.
Yeah, so if you had radio eyes, you would see these flashes going on all over the sky all the time.
I think Dan Thornton, who used to produce Dodcasts, was involved in a lot of the fast radio burst research. So shout out to Dan. And, well, that's been really fascinating chatting with you, Dr. Keith. And thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.